So, tonight, I wanted to talk about the stages of the spiritual path, particularly as expressed in what's known in Zen as the 10 Oxfording pictures. And I have visual aids tonight. The 10 Oxfording pictures date from China, from a very long time ago. I think they antedate the poems that go with them, and the poems that go with them were written in around 1100 to 1200, maybe, in China. And there's two versions of the Oxfording pictures. There's the six Oxfording pictures and the 10 Oxfording pictures, which are the six plus four bonus ones, which we'll talk about. So what I want to do is first introduce you guys to these, and then talk a little bit about the idea of stages generally, and then talk about each one in a little bit of detail and read the poem that goes with them. And so the Oxfording pictures are they kind of contextualize the spiritual journey, the Zen journey, as a young oxherd looking for the ox, the bull, and the bull is the true self, is freedom, is enlightenment, peace, and liberation from our dissatisfying mind. So, the first one is called The Search for the Bull. These particular versions of them, these are actually copies of the ones that hung big and framed in original versions in the dining hall of Zen Mountain Monastery, where I lived for a year and a half. These versions were painted by a modern Japanese master. So, here we have The Search for the Bull. We have the young oxherd looking to me a little bit kind of hunched over and a little bit uncomfortable, and the forest around him is kind of closing in. He looks maybe a little bit lost, a little bit threatened. He's looking over his shoulder, doesn't know quite what he's looking for or where it's coming from. The next one is called Discovering the Footprints. And so here we see that our young oxherd has found the footprints. And now he has a sense of which direction he's going. Stage three is, in this translation, called Perceiving the Bull. Which is lovely, and it's only seeing the back end of the bull, the bull end of the bull. So I'm going to elaborate on these a little later. And this painting is always it's always only ever seeing half the bull. It's not the front of the bull. So it's kind of seeing it from behind. And then the fourth stage, and this is my favorite Oxfording picture, and I'll tell you more about it, is we see the guy, here he is, he's got the whole bull, he sees it right there, and he's got his little lasso around the bull, and he's just locked in a little life and death struggle here. He's really trying to pull this obstinate bull, and it is just not moving. Perhaps you already have an inkling of what this stage may mean. And then taming the bull comes next, and this can be a little bit of a comforting thought for those of you who are imagining that you're going to be stuck wrestling against this bull forever. So here's taming the bull. So here's the ox herder leading the bull fairly amicably along. He's still got the rope on it and pulling along. And the bull is following. And the next stage six, Stage six is actually it's 7 plus 3, not 6 plus 4. Stage six is riding the bow home, and here we see the ox herder. He's now riding the bull, enjoying himself, playing a flute as he goes, and the bull is walking on its own through this path. And then the seventh ox herding picture, which is where the first set of the unelaborated ones end, is called the bull transcendent. And here we see the ox herder, who now, interestingly, looks a little older. And this whole searching for the bull, looking for it, wrestling with it, pulling it back, all of that has kind of dropped away. And here he's just sitting peacefully in a lovely little hut with some much greenery and lovely full moon. In some versions of the ox herding pictures, that's where it ends. The next one is both self and bull transcended. And this here is the Zen circle, the Enso, which is a way of depicting the undepictable, speaking the ineffable. It's the it's an expression of the complete oneness of enlightenment. And then, even this complete oneness of enlightenment is transcended. And we don't even have that. And we heard an echo of that in the piece from the Ginjo Koan I read to start the night, with no trace of enlightenment remains, and this traceless enlightenment continues forever. And even here, we don't stop. The final of the 10 ox herding pictures is in this version called In the World. And here we see the traditional Chinese fat and happy Buddha going bare-chested into the marketplace. Maybe he's got a walking staff in his hand, a satchel of stuff on his back. And this is transcending even that whole big mess about transcending everything. And one of the things that's nice here is the aging of this guy. So I want to talk about these are 10 discrete stages, but it isn't the case that you move from one to another and then that's it, you're done with it. There's a couple of ways that I want to contextualize these stages. One is that there is a kind of forward movement through them, and they do kind of meaningfully depict a piece of what the life of practice is like at different stages. And we're kind of continually going through all of them. And we might find that in one period of our practice life, we're spending more time around stage two, but we're jumping into stage three and stage four, and sometimes we're losing that, we're going to stage one. And we have glimpses of six and seven. And so they aren't, I don't want to portray them as like attainments or categorical shifts. To do that is to kind of reify and harden a piece of the spiritual practice which is continually evolving and flowing for you. And another thing that I wanted to say about the stages is even that presentation of the stages of kind of being in many of them and bouncing around and things, even that has a linearity to it. But there's another way to see it as just kind of a cyclical or spiraling, and there's a way in which we're continually moving through all of them again and again and again, and each time we come to it, we're coming to it with a slightly different view, a slightly different experience, a slightly new relationship to it. And that kind of widening out of the circle is of the spiral is a part of what this path is. So then I want to say a little more about some of these, including reading the poems. Here is number one, The Search for the Bull. In the pasture of the world, I endlessly push aside the tall grasses in search of tall grasses in search of the bull. Following unnamed rivers, lost upon interpenetrating paths of distant mountains, my strength failing and my vitality exhausting, I cannot find the bull. I only hear the locusts cheering through the forest at night. This is kind of a depiction of our lives and our minds before we encounter practice. This is whatever it is that drives us to practice. And this is a portrayal of thinking continually that there's a thing, there's something that you could get or have, or some situation you could get in order that then you would really be happy, and that you just needed maybe that one, or then that one, and then no, that wouldn't quite work out. And this is a portrayal of that. And it's interesting. So here's the observer at his youngest talking about my strength failing and my vitality exhausted. It's a very exhausting way to live. I endlessly push aside the tall grasses, and tall grasses are in the koan literature as in images of the delusive thoughts and the delusive mind that arises. The poem with discovering the footprints. Along the riverbank, under the trees, I discover footprints. Even under the fragrant grass, I see his prints. Deep in remote mountains, they are found. These traces can no more be hidden than one's nose looking heavenward. This is our first encounter with the spiritual path. And for me, some of you have heard me tell this story before. For me, this moment kind of crystallized at a time when I was in college, when I was so just angst-ridden and depressed and stressed out, about my undergraduate thesis, about my relationship with my girlfriend, about what am I going to do with my life, And that was me just being kind of crushed and just overcome by these grasses of my mind. And I was, at the kind of the peak of my anxiety and depression, I was sitting at this lake at my college, and there were in this lake there were ducks. And I was sitting there, and these ducks were just being ducks. And it was clear to me that it was so easy and natural and free for these ducks to just be ducks. And it was so excruciatingly painful for me to be me. But in that moment, I knew, I also saw that I was sure that had to do with how I was using my mind. That it wasn't inherently the case that it had to be harder for me to be me. It's just that I didn't really know how to do that. It isn't a skill I had ever cultivated. It is something that I had lost, like this, like the book. But I had a sense of the potential for agency there, and so that led me to somewhere kind of between two and three, this led me to really in-depthedly pursuing Zen. And it it also led me to live for a year and a half at Tetzin Mount Mahasa. And my that was me going specifically on a bull hunt now. I was going to focus all of my energy into figuring out what it was that was really that was making it so much more painful for me to be me and for these ducks to be these ducks. And that's seeing the prince. And then perceiving the bow, I hear the strong sound, I hear the song of the nightingale. The sun is warm, the wind is mild, willows are green along the shore. Here no bull can hide. What artist can draw that massive head, those majestic horns? So this is the first the first kind of inkling or taste or sighting of what the real fruits of Zen have to offer, which is the perfection of things as they are. Seeing for yourself, not just believing, not just understanding, not believing your teacher who tells you, but saying, oh, I see. Things are, in fact, just as they are. And that is exactly fine. And this, so this is thusness. Which is ta-ta-ta, which we hear in the word tathagata, which is the one come from or to thusness. This is sometimes a dramatic experience, or sometimes it's you know, for me, there was another piece of it. I remember very, very clearly, like just I was specifically where I was at Zen Mountain Monastery, actually doing a writing retreat. When I realized for the first time, and I wrote this in my journal, that the opposite of being depressed wasn't being not depressed. That there was this kind of joyful fineness to things that was news to me at 22. And part of what Zen practice is connecting to that. But then it doesn't mean that we, you know, then only experience happy, joy. But it's this kind of subtler and more pervasive thing, and that's what the poet here is capturing with the song of the nightingale. The sun is warm, the wind is mild, willows are green along the shore, and that's not a special state of the sun. You know, the willows, just feeling the willows, and so this is a kind of admiring and, you know, appreciative receiving of things as they are. And you know, if you do a session, a retreat, or even often a day long sit, there's at least a moment, you know, or maybe one sitting period, or maybe, you know, 2 days, like around, you know, Wednesday or Thursday, when you settle into it and you're like, ah, oh, yeah. And you're like, oh, okay, this is it. Now I've really got this Zen thing. I see. And then, of course, you're dealing with the whole world. We don't stay there. That is a stage, a experience, a passing thing, and it is valuable and important. And you know, it can become part of the foundation of your faith in your practice, your faith in the Dharma, and in the, you know, the universe. But it in fact does not solve all your problems. You've still got all of your years, decades of accumulated habit patterns and your karma and the family karma that came as a result of your family of origin, in all of the ways that we've used our minds wore out these ruts with our grasping and our aversion and believing our stories. The mind does this thing that the mind does, and we react instinctively. We react from anger. We react from lust and grasping. We fall into righteousness and believing that our thoughts are truth, because that's what we've been doing. And so here's the poem to go with stage four, catching the bull. I seize him with a terrific struggle. His great will and power are inexhaustible, as perhaps you can attest. He charges to the high plateau far above the cloud mist, or in an impenetrable ravine he stands. So our moods continually up and down. His great will and power are inexhaustible. And it's interesting because the other place we hear this word liturgically is desires are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. And this is the bow kind of expressing that. And so part of what this is a kind of particularly painful, even excruciating stage to be in, because so there's this realization, there's still this realization of no, I get it, I see, it can be different, and then we're just seeing ourselves doing the same thing over and over again, and you're going, I am seeing myself doing this thing, and I know that that's the source of my suffering, and I just don't want to do that, and here I am doing it again. And then you're like, okay, but no, now I learned from that. I saw that. That did not work out for me. Okay, and here I am doing it again. But the thing that I really want you to appreciate here is that this is the fourth stage. This is great. You're really moving right along. Okay, because there are these three stages where you were still doing all that stuff, but you didn't notice. So now it has developed that you're starting to become aware of the ways you're continually acting from grasping, aversion, and ignorance. The ways you're causing harm. The ways in which you're not being the person you need to be. The ways in which you're kind of habit patterns and all of that kind of impels you to take an action that is not the way of taking up the precepts, or any piece of the precepts that we read tonight. And it's a terrific struggle, and it's really genuinely painful. And for me, I remember that when I was at Zen Mountain Monastery, I would often stand at the threshold of the Zendo, like often before the first night of the Sesshin, and be like, fuck. I don't want to go in there. It's going to be like me and my mind. Can I borrow somebody else's mind? I don't want to. And then I would go in there and I would be struggling with my mind. And at that point in my practice, I misunderstood a certain part of the point of Zazen, and my mind had the tendency to do all of these kind of cyclical kinds of things, and I thought that Zen practice was about trying to grasp it and clamp it down and keep it just from doing this. And the thing is you can do that a little bit. It's not that you can't do it at all. The real problem is that you can do it a little bit for a little period of time, and then it breaks out. You get all this burst of energy, which for me often took the form of depression or sometimes other stuff too. So that was what I was. That was what I was trying to do. As I was struggling with that book. But there's another perspective that I think has maybe to do more with perhaps the sixth stage. In the fifth stage, taming the bull, the whip and rope are necessary, else he might stray off down some dusty road. Being well trained, he becomes naturally gentle. Then, unfettered, he obeys his master. And so this is, in a way here, this one is very clearly talking about the mind. The whip and rope are necessary, are necessary. Discipline is necessary. Really continuing to come back to your practice, back to your breath, back to this moment is still a practice that you need to actively do, actively cultivate. But it comes. And when the bull is trying to stray off down that distant road, you pull on the string and it comes back to this. And strays again, back to this. And he becomes naturally gentle. And so this is where we start to see when just from kind of ceasing to resist things as they are starts to give us moments for natural kindness, for just simple, Buddhism uses the term loving kindness and the term compassion, you know, but those can sound so big and special and like epic and like there's some kind of Buddhist thing you're supposed to be feeling, but it's actually just basic kindness. Basic gentleness, mercy to ourselves, to others, recognizing that suffering being, recognizing that it must really hurt for that suffering being to be suffering, just as it hurts me. And I'm suffering. And then, riding the bull home, mounting the bull, slowly I return homeward. The voice of my flute intones through the evening, measuring with hand beats the pulsating harmony, I direct the endless rhythm. Whoever hears this melody will join me. So this is really lovely. For me, these two ones, the fifth and the sixth, kind of a little bit capture a different way of conceptualizing the mind in Zazen, which I find much more A, possible for me, and B, actually useful in becoming free from my self-created suffering, or free amid or alongside my self-created suffering. Because free from also often makes us think that that suffering then somehow disappears or goes over there, and then we're free from it and we can do it. But it's still here, but we're not fettered to it in the same way. So, but, you know, in the way that I was trying to keep my mind kind of compressed in that little box, what I have gradually realized about this practice is that, so the mind does this thing that the mind does, and there's also this place below it that is undisturbed, that this equanimity, this kind of bigger space, bigger container that holds all of these mental thoughts, these mental formations arising. This is what I'm always expressing with, yes, that's a mental formation. And so the mental formations are things that narrow our focus to just this, and we can sometimes think we need to replace this mental formation with this mental formation. But that isn't the case. It's actually the case that this whole space is the kind of peace, freedom, spaciousness. And this is where we're now, he's now able to make choices where his energy goes. He's no longer being directed by, he's no longer struggling against the bull, or even having to really, you know, focusedly you know, pay attention to the rope and lead the ball, and now life is expressing itself kind of creatively. And this is a kind of expression of being the person we need to be, living the life we need to be living. Or what Maizumi Roshi, my first teacher's teacher, used to say is, appreciate your life. That's what the Zen path is. It's learning to appreciate your life. And this is an expression of that, appreciating our life. And that's nothing special. It isn't that your life needs to feel a special way. You can also appreciate your illness, appreciate your sickness, appreciate your death, your grief, your sadness, your longing. And then the bowl transcended. Astride the bowl, I reach home. I am serene. The bowl, too, generous. Like that. The dawn has come. In blissful repose, within my thatched dwelling, I have abandoned the whip and ropes. So this is in one sense, this is in one sense an ending on the linear single passage stage thing. So part of what the Buddha described all of his teachings, all of the Dharma, as like a raft to carry you across the river of suffering to the other side, to freedom and liberation. And then the Buddha said, and when you get to the other side, don't keep carrying the raft on your head. Leave the raft go. Even the Dharma, even the Buddha's words themselves, even the teachings of the Buddha, of Zen, of Buddhism, those fall away. So this, the first line is, astride the bowl, I reach home. And so also astride the bowl is there's also less of a struggle there between the way life is expressing itself, between the way our mind is being our mind, and I reach home. And this home is what for the people who do come back like a second or fourth time to something like this, it's because there's this sense that sitting here quietly, just sitting, there's a sense of coming home to ourselves. There's a sense of rightness, of you know, and this also speaks to, you know, the fact that we're all kind of continually going through aspects of these stages in whatever predominant stage we are. Because even in the second stage, there's a sense of that coming home. Even when you first glance catch a glimpse of the tracks, you're like, oh, yeah, oh, that's what I'm looking for. The bowl, too, can rest. That seems very kind and compassionate, and recognizing that this bowl that you've been struggling with, that's a being too, and that it isn't just about you or him or and so it isn't about your enlightened mind or your habit conditioned mind. That too can rest. And then we go into the extra quarters with the super zen stuff. So stage 8, both bull and self transcended. So here is bull transcended. Here is transcending self as well. Whip, rope, person, and bull all merge in no thing. This heaven is so vast, no message can stain it. How may a snowflake exist? How may a snowflake exist in a raging fire? Here are the footprints of the ancestors. So this is speaking about seeing eyeball to eyeball entwined with the ancestors of the Buddha way, and this is a clear kind of glimpse of that tricky Buddhist term of emptiness. And I wanted to read a nice portrayal of this eighth stage from this book called Let Go, Buddhist Guide to Breaking Free of Habits by Martin Baxter. I don't love the phrase let go, although I did this book, because letting go implies a little more sometimes you can't let go. And a more kind of robust practice is to let be. But even letting be implies that the universe is somehow asking your permission. It's recognizing that the universe is being. So, but regarding the ox and ox herder are both forgotten. In the eighth picture, there is just an empty circle. Both boy and ox have disappeared. Once the roots of the habits have dissolved, your life is simplifying. Habits brought complication to your life. Previously, any small incident or encounter would be transformed into a huge difficulty that would last days. Previously, everything was so terribly important. Now, what used to be a trigger to your painful habits has no place to activate. It is just like a river going into the sea. There are no special ripples, just the continuity of water. In the same way, in a life free of habits, there is a continuity of actions and life flowing into each other, fueled by creative responses. The actions and responses come from a spacious, stable, and open place and return to a spacious, stable, and open place. Nothing is disturbed. You have realized there is no place for the habits to exist and no substance to the habits. They are just ephemeral phenomena. They are just mental formations, arising, passing away. When the grasping goes, there is no place to stick. This is what is remarkable. The habits seem so strong and all-powerful, but actually, they were not. They have been diffused. At this stage, you see and experience that you are not as fixed, limited, and as solid as you thought you were. There is more fluidity, flexibility, and possibility of movement than you thought. Your life becomes a narrative story that you can create. Your own gaze or the gaze of others does not fix you. So there's a lot of really beautiful stuff there. And it's also it's a expression and a recognition of the freedom that comes from recognizing mental formations as mental formations and being able to continue to keep a perspective on this other sense. And recognizing urges as urges, recognizing habits as habits. All of these things, and even forms themselves, bowl, self, other, all of those things are also dharmas. They're also formations. And then that passes too. Reaching the source. Too many steps have been taken, returning to the root and the source. Better to have been blind and deaf from the beginning, dwelling in one's true abode, unconcerned with and without, the river flows tranquilly on and the clouds are red. So this is a reminder. So this is a reminder that for all of this path, for all of this traveling, for all of these stages, for all of these moving through it, in a really important way, we don't end up somewhere else. We don't end up someone else. We don't then start living an enlightened Buddha's life. It's still us in our life. It's still this life. And however special the states of mind we attain in meditation, it's sometime that meditation ends and we're back to just this. And just this now is sparkling, radiant, scintillating with potential, and entirely enough. In a way, if you compare this to the first stage, it's kind of the same for us, but there's much less of a sense of kind of ominousness. It's just still the same world, still trees, grasses, the breeze, but it changes. And then, in the world, barefoot and naked of rest, I mingle with the people of the world. My clothes are ragged and dust-laden, and I am ever blissful. I use no magic to extend my life. Now, before me, the dead tree becomes alive. One of the things that my first teacher, Daido, used to say is that Zen is the path up the mountain, and enlightenment is the top of the mountain, the peak of the mountain. And what do you do when you get there? You reach it and you keep right on going, back down, back into the city. And I mingle with the people of the world, and so this is a reminder that the Zen path is not a path of seclusion, of isolation, of getting this special state of emptiness or whatever, and just staying in your little meditative environment. It's going into the world and being with all of these suffering beings, and responding to the suffering, and crying tears with them, and even in that sadness, being ever blissful. And it says here, I use no magic to extend my life. This is, I think, a reference to, so Zen is what Buddhism became when it met Taoism in China. And Taoism was, in fact, intensely concerned about literally attaining immortality, not deathlessness in a way that is that Zen sometimes speaks about, but literally the body living to be 100, 200, or immortal even. And there are Taoist practices that can perhaps extend your life. There are lovely energetic things that you can do, and Qigong and all of these things. And this is part of what we talk about in the five remembrances. How about the nature to grow old? There is no way to escape growing old. There also was no way for these Taoists to escape growing old, try as they might. So this is a way in which we acknowledge the reality of this, of the tenth stage, even from the beginning. And now before me, the dead tree becomes alive. And this is when we start to see that even life and death are, and trees and beings, even these things are just more mental formations, just more distinctions, and that they are not themselves the truth that they appear to be, and that, or the separateness that they appear to be. And so, even as from one perspective that tree is dead, from another perspective that tree is alive. That tree is me. That tree is this whole single, vividly functioning system that we all express, partake of, manifest. This may or may not be specifically the fat happy Buddha of Chinese restaurants, but it may be too. And that guy is called Hotai in Japanese. Putai in Chinese, and he is actually the future Buddha. He's the Buddha Maitreya, the Buddha who is yet to be born, when everybody who's ever heard of the teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha has died and fallen away. Then, and there's no such thing as the Dharma anymore. Then Maitreya comes and teaches the Dharma to that aeon, to that kappa, and that's this guy. So he's in the world. He's carrying something around. It's not that he isn't carrying anything. What's in there? Maybe goodies. 3, 6, and 5. Maybe it's things that might be useful to other people. Another phrasing of this poem says he goes into the marketplace, right, with bliss-bestowing hands. And those of you who have ever done a boundless way session might remember that there's a point when the head of practice goes around and walks around with the Kiyosaku, the awakening stick that you can ask for, and they will slap you with it on the shoulder, and you get fed and you get energized. Or if you're kind of more sensible, you can do a different kind of bow, and then she will come and do a little 30-second neck rub for you. And I'm always reminded of the Buddha in the marketplace with his bestowing hands as Jan comes up to me. So that is the 10 offering pictures. Did anybody? And so now I'm going to leave some space for questions or observations or whatever. Maybe I'll circulate these and start them each with a different person. Okay. I think nobody's going to get to look at them in order.
So, all these let us be us?
What?
All these let us be us.
All of these let us be us. We're not ducks. It would be really silly to go. Well, that's the thing, though, is that it's not that I should try to be a duck. I shouldn't be trying to be out there in the pond quacking and eating breadcrumbs or whatever. That's institutionalizable, right? But what the ducks are doing is being themselves just as they are. And that's what we can do. Be ourselves just as we are. And not our teachers just as they are. And not those other people, but ourselves with our strengths and limitations. And well, especially when I've made the silly choice to distribute them to folks out of order. Your experience of the stages is yeah, right. Well, that's
how it is.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's an honest recognition of the way they actually go. One of the others chants that we do on retreat. It says that just to portray it in literary form is to stain it with defilement. So this is also what they say in Zen. Of trying to capture the spring breeze, the true practice of the path in a bottle. When you put it in a bottle, what you have there is no longer the spring breeze, by virtue of the fact that you put it in a bottle. But that isn't to say that there's no breeze. There is a breeze. There is a path. And this is a way of conceptualizing and talking and seeing our experience and kind of being reassured in a way that we're not always going to be, or that we're not, I was going to say that, be reassured that we're not always going to be locked in the struggle against this book. But actually, what it is that when we look really carefully, we notice that even now, we're not always locked in that struggle against the book. It's a mountain monastery. They had, I know that every time we talk about this place, I don't make it sound like somewhere that anyone in their right mind would ever want to go. But it has strengths. It has downsides, but it has strengths. But Zen Mountain Monastery, they had a very reified and formal understanding of the stages. They're like, if you're counting your breath, you're in stage two. If you're, and then when you practice Mu, and you know, see Mu, then you're in stage three. And then as you're doing the gateless gate, that's stage four. And then, you know, and there was lists of readings that you were supposed to do at the different stages. And that, so, yeah. So that's one way to go with all this. And you got a little special folder for the stage three people. Stage three information that you have.
That's so silly. I'm
sorry. Oh, yes. Yeah.
Like the secret society or something.
Yeah.
But you're not supposed to tell people about how to get the merit badges, because then you have to tell them all of them. You get the merit badges, you can tell how you got them.
So my understanding is that it means one thing and you go straight through.
No. Well, that is definitely a part of their understanding that gets expressed. Yes. And they do use it as a tool to... yeah. Yes.
So what was good about this monastery?
It taught me how to follow the footprints of the Lord. I still had to do it. They also kind of taught a few things that were distracting and kind of, in my experience, turned out to be counter to my finding the ox that I had lost. I was endlessly pushing aside the tall grasses in search for the bull, following unnamed rivers, lost in the interpenetrating paths of distant mountains. My strength is failing, as my vitality is exhausted. I was miserable, and they said, "Here's what you can do: sit down, count your breath." And it was a structure that enabled me to do that. Because I had no discipline whatsoever. There's no way I would have done it without the kind of militaristic structure at that point, and the kind of support and my path to here is a direct outgrowth of there. You know, it isn't it. So, and I am grateful for that, and I'm grateful for the difficulty, you know, that I encountered, because that also was part of what brought me here, which I'm grateful for. And I'm grateful for Crohn's disease and depressive mind and all of that. Couldn't get into it. Thank you, guys.